store, or find us on social media.
Hello, good afternoon. Shalom, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz, joining you from the anarchist jurisdiction known as the Hertz Bunker, my cinder block paradise, fully stocked with cans of soup and tuna and ready for every eventuality. And joining me from his fortress of solitude is, I hope, on the line, Adam A. Donaldson, our chief assignment editor and Guelph Politico and host of End Credits and an amazing multimedia presence in the community. Adam, are you with us?
Oh, I made it.
Oh, fantastico. Good to hear. I'm so glad. Yes. So today in the program, what do we have? Oh, man, a full slate. I think that's why I'm a little distracted, because so much has happened this week. BC has called a snap election. Provincial Pandemic Election 2, I guess we'll call it, on the West Coast, and we'll dig a bit into that. Also, notorious Ruth Bader Ginsburg has died this past week, and that has caused huge ripples in U.S. politics. And before the break, we're going to talk about the COVID wave. Is it a wave? Are we in the second wave? Did it ever leave us? We'll dig into that, of course. But off the top, Adam, we finally got the throne speech that we were promised, and also a bonus speech from Prime Minister Trudeau after that, and he spoke mostly about COVID. I don't know, were you able to catch any of that live? I wasn't personally, but
I did watch it live. I watched all the, because it wasn't just Justin, it was all the opposition leaders, with the exception of the Green leader, had speeches afterwards.
The follow-up. Two of them completely remote due to COVID cases among their pack, I guess, families, and maybe, I don't think any staffers, there probably are some staffers infected, but so that affected who was present for it, I guess, in person.
Yes. I'm not sure why, because, you know, the Greens have three seats. I'm not sure why they get cut out, and maybe why Elizabeth May, who is the internal parliament Green leader until the new leader is chosen to get a chance, and, you know, Jody Wilson-Raybo sits alone, so maybe she should have got a speech. But yeah, it was the big four, and it went largely as I think people thought it was going to go.
Yeah, and it felt, well, I did see one clip of Elizabeth May talking about it, saying that the biggest issue was the climate emergency, and of course none of the opposition parties are completely happy or happy at all with what was presented, particularly the Conservatives. And I think what was said by Candace Bergen could probably go to almost any throne speech ever. It's full of buzzwords and grand gestures. I mean, isn't that what the throne speech is, really? A grand gesture, guys in hats, and was there fanfare, like all of that jive, or did they tone it down a little bit?
No, it was the full spiel, which completely caught me off guard. It was, they had
the
guy from the Senate, the usher of the Black Rod. He had to march down Wellington Street.
Oh, really? So it was yeah.
Yeah, to the temporary setup for the House of Commons, because the House of Commons is in the middle of a 10-year renovation.
Renovation and pandemic equals new digs, yeah.
Right. And so he had to go down Wellington Street. He had to be announced, the guy with the staff, I guess it's the sergeant at arms.
Yeah.
But he has like the bigger staff, and he had to go out and
bang on the door, right?
The Black Rod guy was there, and he comes back into the house and says, "Mr. Speaker, I have the messenger from the Senate." And it was the whole rigmarole. It was
very formal.
Considering the circumstances, I mean, we probably could have lost the pomp, kept the circumstance.
Yeah.
But
I mean, maybe
yeah,
they're legally obligated to do that. I don't know. I bet you there's a line somewhere saying you must do this or it doesn't count. Because why would you bother? Why wouldn't you just, have a Zoom meeting and go, "Hey, okay, here's our throne speech." And it was full of Some juicy things, I suppose. Do you want to run a bit through the litany, Adam? Or
yes.
I'm sure our notes are identical.
Well, first of all, the Canadian Emergency Wage Subsidy has been extended to next summer. It was originally going to run out in December. So far, that program has cost about $35 billion. This is kind of a direct quote, significant long-term sustained investment to create a Canada-wide early learning and child care system. So basically trying to universalize child care, more subsidies for before and after school programs, some changes to the Canadian disability benefit. So it's going to be more like the guaranteed income supplement, which is kind of designed to help people who have disabilities, who may be struggling through the pandemic. They recommitted to the getting greenhouse gas to 30% below 2005 levels by 2030. Let's see. And one of the bigger ones was they are going to amend the criminal code to make it a criminal violation for people who neglect seniors. And of course, that's kind of directed at some of the systemic conditions in long-term care homes that resulted in so many seniors dying in care during the spring phase of the pandemic too. And there's also a bit about police reforms, trying to address changes in the RCMP to have more civilian oversight. And there is also a thing about working with airlines to create new regional routes, which probably isn't what the airlines themselves were hoping for, because they've been trying to get Parliament for months to come up with some kind of bailout package. I don't think they're looking for Trudeau and the gang to start telling them how to fly.
And they've been killing off regional routes as well, so that's probably not what they want to hear, unless it's going to come with a chunk of change. And it sounds like quite a bit of change is going to come with this, although they never do assign dollar values to it. This is the aspirational thing. They never say, and it's going to cost this, right? It's just because the pricing out has to come in the did Loy Longfellow last week or a couple weeks ago call it the financial snapshot? Is there going to be a budget? If the government there won't be a budget, but technically I would think there has to be backing this, right? Is that correct?
From what I understand, they confirmed what Lloyd said last week, which was that they're going to have some kind of fiscal update. They are not going to have a full budget this year, which
makes parties lose their mind, particularly the Conservatives, right?
Well, it's so hard to know for certain without the hard numbers, because the analysis coming back isn't on all these individual programs. The CERB has cost this much. The wage subsidy has cost this much. We spent so much on PPE, and I think people are, and this is true at the provincial level as well. We have not had an Ontario budget this year as well, and I have not heard anything from the provincial government saying that they're trying to get something together before the end of the year. I mean, it's also worth noting too that the end of the fiscal year for both the province and the feds is March, so we're about halfway through the typical fiscal year for both those levels. So maybe they could be, around February, March next year when we get when we typically get the budget. Maybe we'll get something like a wrap-up of all the spending that's happened in this fiscal year, as well as perhaps a budget for the next fiscal year. That seems like a lot of work, but at this point I can't, there's a lot of pre-work that goes into the budget too, a lot of consultations and things, and that's something Lloyd addressed last week in our interview, is he hasn't heard anything about that either in terms of getting that pre-budget work done and those pre-budget consultations. So it seems like, there is definitely not going to be a budget before the end of the year.
Yeah, so promises made, but as to whether they're going to be passed out, I did see Chrystia Freeland saying when asked about, well, how much is all this going to cost? Because as we know, the deficit has gone, I think it's at about $340 billion now, and probably with all the spending that's going on, going to reach $400 billion. She said, well, it was kind of funny. She's like, well, getting money is cheap now because interest rates are low. And I was like, oh, God, I don't think that's what they wanted to hear. But yeah,
that's not the quote you want hanging around your neck.
No, No, bit of freewheeling going on there. But that's, I guess, when put on the spot. That's what happens. Well, it's not going to be this isn't a long-term vision. This isn't like for 10 years. It's almost, I wouldn't say day by day, but it's literally month by month, right? It's not, this isn't throne speeches are usually a long view. And some of the stuff in this was rehashed from last year. And some of the things like childcare is rehashed from 10, 20, 30 years and throne speeches ago, right? When I heard that about childcare, I was like, where I heard this before? I think it was under Paul Martin. I was like, oh yeah, childcare program. You know, that's the high speed trains of this budget, this throne speech, right? It's like, yeah, childcare. And everybody goes, yes, childcare. And then it's like, well, we can't really. Or they'll pass it off to the provinces, right? Which is, I'm surprised. You mentioned the charges about long-term care homes. So often it's like, well, long-term care homes are the provinces' responsibilities. And now it's, well, we're going to have seemingly some kind of federal charge on that. Federal charges are usually more serious than provincial or otherwise, right? So that's going to be interesting as to how they're going to hack that out, because I'm not really sure what that's going to look like.
Well, I mean, it's a legal concern. So it's you could probably come up with some universal standards for what's to be expected for the care of the elderly. And one of the reasons why, of course, long-term care is a provincial issue, like healthcare itself, is that presumably each region has its own unique healthcare or long-term care needs. But I think we could probably agree as a nation where the line is between taking care of an elder and elder abuse.
Oh, absolutely. And as to whether anybody will go to, well, I don't think anybody's going to jail. It'll be something like a fine or a huge fine or something. But anyway, that remains to be seen. So the other parties, what was it that Aaron O'Toole's comment was that the country has never been more divided? I wasn't surprised at that, but he obviously wrote that before this. I personally don't think in the scheme of things, in the greater scheme of things, that the country is more divided. If anything, right now, there's probably been a record amount of collaboration between the provinces and the feds. I know there has been obviously the usual grumbling about healthcare, and that's ongoing, and other monies that are passed around. But you know, I think the relationships, particularly with Trudeau and the premiers of Ontario and Quebec, has been, I wouldn't say unprecedented, but if you went back a year and heard the way they were smack-talking each other and then move forward a year and it's like, yeah, thanks, Justin. It's like, oh, my God. So yeah. The divided comment doesn't really fly, but I mean, that's just, it's pretty much bog standard talk after a throne speech, right? It's like, it's terrible. The country's falling apart. Like, well, yeah, but, you know.
I don't know who wrote who was involved in, or what was really involved in crafting Aaron O'Toole's speech, because he opened it with this very sort of relatable thing about how, you know, he's in quarantine now, you know, the
family's
pandemic got over. Yeah, he's got issues. Him and his wife have COVID. And then he talked about how this is not how he thought his first month as the conservative leader was going to go. And, like, fair enough, we are living in unprecedented times, and times change almost on an hourly basis. And then he goes into that, and he's like, we're more divided than ever. And it's like, well, no, we're not. There was just a Leger poll that said, like, 83% of people think that wearing masks is a civic duty, which is, like, crazy. Like, can you imagine –
if a party got that, yeah, they'd be the government for the rest of time. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, can you imagine then, like, if there were numbers like that in the United States or anything? It would just be, you know, you were talking about how great the unity was. And then he went on about the Chinese Communist Party and how they're trying to screw us on trade. And it's like, nobody's talking about that.
Nice one, Trump. Yeah, whatever.
Right.
But
it was a very Trumpian thing, which is like,
yeah,
dude, have you not seen the numbers for Trump, like approval numbers for Trump in Canada? You are not going to win that way. Who do you think you are talking to right now? Mm-hmm. It was just bizarre.
Well, he looked surprisingly well, considering he's somebody with COVID, so he's one of the non-strugglers. But I was actually, I finally found out why Justin Trudeau's face was so screwed up at the last throne speech, and it was that Julie Payette added 11 paragraphs the last time. I was like, I had to look it up. I was like, why is his face like that? She was freewheeling last. I don't think there was any any additions this time, maybe a couple, but it wasn't 11 paragraphs worth. So I think maybe she's been told in no uncertain terms to, like, you know, cool it, Jules, you know?
Well, I think there was like a maybe half a page of additional text from her. But I mean, she's also in a very different position now. And I mean, a lot of people are wondering, well, why was Trudeau having like an additional speech, like a special features kind of speech at, you know, elsewhere on the DVD of yesterday's news, was because he didn't want the story to be Julie Payette, who's delivering the government agenda, because there's just been so much, crap covering on her because of stuff going on in Rideau Hall and those allegations. So,
because that was unprecedented, right? That I even, like, during the war, I don't think there's been a throne speech and then the speech after the speech, but I guess.
Yeah,
going back that far, we didn't have the tech to do it then. It would have been a film or a newsreel. And speaking of something that's taking up all the newsreels these days is the resurgence of COVID, as predicted by many, including me and yourself, climbing the charts today. 409 cases in Ontario. I didn't get a chance to do the deep dive on all the numbers, but I'm going to hazard a guess that they're up. In local university rankings, Guelph is doing well, but they're beating Laurier and Western. That almost sounds like a sports report, but Western really blew it. And there's a great analysis. What is the paper again? The Western, I wanted to say the Western Standard, but their campus paper did a really good breakdown and graphic on, as a lot of the health departments are doing, as to how the cases spread from this house party and that house party, and then they went to this club and that club, like the complete contact trace breakdown. And it gives people a good visual as to why the spread is back or coming back. Now, I don't think it's completely fair of Doug Ford. Always, he's like, the wild parties. This is all the wild parties. Like, you can have a quiet party, right, that spreads these things, right? It's making it sound like there's wild people that are spreading this. It can spread, you know, any which way. And one of the problems right now is that a lot of the unknown origin cases, which is worrisome, is community spread. So they're not, there's quite a few people out there, it sounds like the majority, is that they don't actually know how people are getting it. It's not necessarily a wild party or the church service that had no masks, or the strip bar you were at, or whatever, you know, the ones that we hear about, rather than there's a bunch of people in the community that have this and we have absolutely no idea how they got it. And that, to me personally, is kind of frightening.
Well, there was in Ottawa, there was a barbecue, and it was in one of the parks, and 40 people were at the barbecue, and that led to 105 people catching COVID over the span of several days, because 2 days after the barbecue, two people started having COVID symptoms. So you have a thing with 40, and I can't imagine that this barbecue, which sounds like kind of like a family and friend situation,
right? But it's expanded. But it's not even expanded bubble. It's too many people.
Well, it's that too.
But sharing the potato salad spoon, right? Yeah, whatever it is.
I bet you're having a loud and rowdy barbecue in the middle of an Ottawa park. So it was just people hanging out, having food, talking, and it went from there. You know, you get 105 cases. Of course, Ottawa is one of the hot spots. So if there's some place you do not want to have a gathering of 40 people, even outdoors, it is Ottawa.
Yeah, and that's it, too. There is regionalism to it. Like, Guelph, was it still one case today? I think it was one case. And that's really impressive. It's kind of a testament to town. Of course, one case that we know about, right? Because it's never just that number. There is a factor that they use. It's like, well, it's probably more, but there is one that we know about. I mean, that is ridiculously low, right? We're getting, like, onesie, twosie every day. And I personally think that's fantastic. But when you look at other jurisdictions or the province as a whole, like, it's just the to jump to the states, because it, you know, our neighbors, but yet it's almost completely out of control still. And you've got Trump saying, I think it was the day that they clocked 200,000 deaths, he was like, he gave himself an A+ for his response. That's 200,000 dead. That's not even 200,000 with COVID, because they're in, it's huge, right? And that's,
well, it's not even just the dead, right? Because
The injured as well. I don't know how you describe it. The people that, yeah, that are having lasting effects from COVID, or, you know, deep effects, which is also a thing, right?
And we don't know if people, if it's going to be a recurring thing. We don't know if once you've had COVID, you are protected from COVID. And it's 41,000 cases a day in the United States. And Dr. Fauci...
lost it this week, Denise.
Yeah. No. I enjoyed watching that clip of him taking Rand Paul down.
Oh, was it Rand Paul? I only saw the one half of the discussion. He was like, he was reaming somebody. It was Rand Paul. And there you go. Surprise. Yeah.
It was noted epidemiologist, I Dr. Rand Paul. He said that the daily case counts had to get under 10,000 or there would be trouble. And that's almost his exact words. And now they're still at 41,000, which is four times greater than the red line Fauci laid out for trouble versus non-trouble. And it seems that, you know, people don't really seem to care. By people, I mean, you know, the main political leaders in the country, because what are they doing right now? And we'll get into that later. Like, they're all a flurry about putting another Supreme Court justice on the seat. They're not seeming worried about dealing with the pandemic at all, even as it you have 41,000 cases a day. They just crossed 200,000 deaths. I don't know if they've crossed 7 million cases total. I haven't seen the official numbers from Johns Hopkins today yet, but it's not impossible that they have now crossed the magic 7 million mark, which is incredible. Considering that the other major hotspots for this are India and Brazil, which are not exactly in the same league, medicine wise as the United States.
Those numbers are fake. Yeah, that's going to be something like that kind of. Oh, and the UK, of course, as well, which is one that I follow fairly closely, and the cases on the rise as well. And they're taking measures to lock down again to a degree in places. And they have been doing that. They were concentrating, at least in Scotland, on regional lockdowns. It's like, this zone, you better behave. And of course they have their ream of stories as well about, you know, one last party before they lock everything down. It's like, no guys, don't do that. Back to Ontario. It sounds like, and I'm not sure how this is going to work yet, and I don't think the people that have been appointed to do it know how it's going to work yet, is COVID tests in the pharmacies. Particularly the large chain ones, Shoppers and Rexall, are going to take some of the pressure off the testing centers. And we've seen this, well, our neighbors in Kitchener, at least, massive lineups. And it sounds like it got shut down again today, like people lining up at 2:33 in the morning. And it's like, no, sorry, we can't take you today. But I booked an appointment. No, sorry. There was some kind of greater problem with the testing province-wide? Like, I don't know if it was in terms of crunching the numbers or distributing materials. Did you hear anything like this? It was like, that was what the problem was. It was like, there's a bit of a glitch in the system.
I don't know for sure. I think one of the primary problems is they've been doing more tests than there is laboratory capacity for. It's the system kind of wasn't designed for all the lineups, for all the people lining up. And it's not just, I mean, the Kitchener situation is kind of unique in that you have people lining up at like the wee small hours of in the morning, like 5 hours before the test sites,
like,
even open.
Concert ticket lines from the old days, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know, when the PlayStation 2 went on sale. Remember that?
Our ages with our frames of reference.
Well, I was working at the electronics counter at Zeller's at the time, and there lined up for, you know, the new video games and stuff. But yeah, I'm not sure what precisely is going on in Kitchener that the Grand River Hospital drive-through clinic is just that swamped 2 days in a row. And there have been problems too at our COVID assessment center. They had to shut down 4 hours early on Tuesday because they had reached capacity. And of course, it's worth noting too that they're not taking bookings. I don't believe any of the COVID centers take online bookings, or you can't phone in a reservation. You have to go and physically stand in line and wait for your turn. I'm not sure how much of that would be solved. Maybe if they did start allowing COVID centers to start just booking things. I mean, it's entirely possible, too, that that could get away from them really, really fast. But the whole thing with the pharmacies, though, that was big news yesterday. And I saw it happening on my Twitter feed, is that they announced this list, the provincial government, of 60 pharmacies that were going to start taking tests on tomorrow Friday.
Yeah.
And they started calling around to the pharmacies going, hey, so, you know, you're doing tests, COVID tests tomorrow, right? And the pharmacies answered one of three ways. Either one, yeah, we are in the process of setting up for that now. Two, they know about it, but it won't be for a couple of weeks until they get the materials. Or three, and this is utterly surprising, they called pharmacies who said, we literally found out about this at the same time the public did. We have not heard anything from head office. We have not heard anything from our local public health unit. It was just completely out of thin air for a couple of these pharmacies, at least. And by and large, the pharmacies that were called, at least in Toronto by the Toronto journalists, mm-hmm. was category 2 and 3. There were very few category 1s where they were ready to roll this out tomorrow.
Yeah, so the touch of political expediency going on there. And I recall years ago when I had to get a flu shot for reasons, and went into the Rexall and they had signs up and said, I shouldn't name names, I guess, but there's only like two places in town you can go and walk in. Big sign up, flu shot here, flu shot here, flu shot. Went to the back, they're like, no, we don't do those. I'm like, come on, man, let's get a big sign up. And that's leading into the flu shots. It's also highly recommended that people will get those. But I have noticed that, at least the one on campus isn't happening this year. So I'm not sure if that's going to be within the pharmacy's jurisdiction as well. They're going to have to carve out a little spot specifically for shots and tests, I think. And some of them won't be able to. I think that's why they've aimed for the larger chains, who are fairly well connected too. So it kind of makes sense, like, that it's possible that Ford could have released that and just assumed that his, I was going to say his friends, but that's not particularly fair, the larger players in the province would be able to take care of it. But it kind of implies that somewhere in a boardroom or on Zoom somewhere, there was a discussion about it, because you can't just drop that out of the sky, at least not to, you know, corporate headquarters. But maybe the trickle down is you get somebody at the pharmacy who's kind of like, I didn't realize that.
Right. The problem isn't how many places are doing tests. The problem is that there are only so many laboratories that can then process the test. Literally, they could have somebody stand on a street corner and stick a swab up your nose.
But test here, $5.
But you still have to send the test somewhere for it to be processed to find out if that the person who had that swab up their nose has COVID or not.
Oh, the swab up the nose. Yeah, I guess they're working on spit tests and other things. And there was one released for children in BC, which looks pretty good. I'd be more into that than the swab on the brain. But if you need the test, you need the test. And just, I guess as a small PSA too, people out there should definitely still be very mindful of the rules and masks. Kind of like we've been doing with the show, we're social distant. We haven't seen each other in 6 months, except on Zoom. And, take these things very seriously. And I'm very wishful that I don't get COVID, but if I do, I'm going to find the anti-maskers that went into the planet Bean and have a little chat while I'm coughing on them. But I probably shouldn't say that kind of thing on the radio, but, you know, that's hypothetically, everybody stay well, listeners stay well, and let's hope for the best. But of course, this is going to be a topic we're going to discuss again, no doubt. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. We're heard every Thursday at 5 p.m. We're going to take a bit of a break, have some announcements, maybe a little bit of music slid in there, and we will be back in short order. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Ah, yes, one of the greatest, or well-known at least, revenge songs ever. That was Bruce Coburn from his album Stealing Fire, 1983. That's sort of a request. And the song, of course, anyone who's around definitely knows that song. That song was If I Had a Rocket Launcher. Yes, you are there. Okay, I wasn't sure. Sorry, a bit of a glitch here in the bunker, but it's all sorted out now. But that's okay. So if I hear laughter, I know everything is grand. So speaking of grand, one of the grand dames of America and justice, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, passed away, or as she is known on CHC, or sorry, a local media conglomerate. Ruth Badger Ginsburg. I laughed so hard. I mean, it's a typo, but I also thought, you know, that Ruth Bader Ginsburg would have probably, judging by her sense of humor, from what I know, would have found that funny because she loved being called Notorious RBG. So Ruth Badger Ginsburg. And, you know, realistically, I suppose, Adam, she was a bit of a badger at times. Get in there and that is how she became notorious, just by her reputation alone. It was a phenomenal life and justice.
Yeah, it's kind of a bit sad that the politics of what's going to happen to her seat is sort of overwhelmed any and all pausing to reflect on just what... just how great her accomplishments were, not just even just as a Supreme Court justice, being the second woman Supreme Court justice ever, but also her work as a litigator. And I actually did the work of looking up some of the famous cases she worked on. And there was the one with Weinberger versus Wiesenfeld, which was the case of a married couple, and the wife was the breadwinner of the family. She had a steady job as a teacher versus Steven Wiesenfeld, who was did something in computers, but this was like the 70s before it was like highly profitable.
Before it was the big time, yeah.
Right. And she passed away. She died in childbirth, so he's left with their newborn son. He was unable to get widower's benefits, survivor's benefits, because he was a widower. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg took on the case and was able to secure him the survivor's benefits he was owed, put forward or at least popularize this notion that it wasn't just up to the woman to be the caregiver of a child, that it is also a man's responsibility too. And then there was another case that Charles Moritz, I think it was Morris v. Commissioner, where it was a man who tried to deduct the caretaker costs for his mother, but he was unmarried. He had never been married. He didn't have kids. And it seemed to be this entirely foreign idea. And this was like 1973, 74, that an unmarried man would have caretaker costs, even for an older parent. And so RBG took them to court. I think that just went to the appeals court. Wiesenfeld went all the way to the Supreme Court, but I think that the Moritz case only went to the appeals court. But yeah, what I find really interesting about her legal career is the stride she made for gender equality, not by necessarily always representing women and taking their case to the higher court. It was by representing the men and turning the situation on their head. And there is something like there's like a real kind of like cleverness to that.
Oh, absolutely.
That I think we have not been able to really truly commemorate in these remembrances, because it feels like we're drowning in the politics of the current situation.
And that's exactly
I love those stories.
Oh yeah, the stories are impressive. I think people have some idea of the magnitude of what she was able to accomplish over, I guess, about a 50-year arc, but it was probably longer. But initially, she was, when you think back to the times when she went to Harvard Law School, she was like one of the only women and Jewish and not offered any jobs when she graduated, even though she was top of the class. top of the class at Harvard Law and no offers. And you know, she's very clear from that. I mean, if that something like that doesn't turn you into a fighter, but it sounds like she had to fight for absolutely everything up to a point. I guess, you know, you fight and then you end up on the Supreme Court, and then I guess you're still fighting, and that, you know, also kind of proven in the way that she fought her disease as well, because she had had cancer and bouts with cancer for quite some time, but it's just so, she called her tenacious RBG because she just would not let go, right? So
it seemed like cancer had a personal thing against her because she had gotten cancer so many times.
Oh boy, yeah. Well, I happened to see today that Trump was, there's two things. He was wearing a mask, which was odd, but he also saw it just before airtime there that they were booing him. He was visiting RBG's casket, mm-hmm. and the boos, it was quite audible. This was like a 1 minute clip, and he had to stay. He must. I'm not sure what Twitter says right now, but having to stand there and take that, and I think they were yelling, "Vote him out." I just watched it very quickly before it came on the air, and I was like, "Whoa!" But you know, he's earned that. There's of everything that's gone on this week, in particular, when he said, "Well, I don't think her last words were, you know, can you wait until a new president comes along?" I'm paraphrasing here, obviously, before you appoint my replacement. So she knew she was going to go, right? And he's like, "Oh, I don't think those were words. I think they were written by somebody else." Like, he obviously does not know this woman, right? Has no clue. He knows of her, but he does not know her, right? So that's to say something like that, but it's very Trump and Trumpian to do that. And I take it you've probably heard of her as one of his star possibilities, who's going to be nominated, because he's very clear. He's like, "Oh, it's going to be a woman." But man, it sounds like she just, you know, obviously arrived on the bus from Crazy Town to be his nominee. Sorry, I shouldn't say things like that. I take that back, but you know what I'm getting at. It sounds like the nominee, and this was on one of our shows, actually, Democracy Now!, which is heard on at 11 o'clock during the week here on CFRU. The Amy Barrett is a member of something called People of Praise, mm-hmm. Which is a very deep Catholic community, and they spoke to a woman who equated it to being in a cult. So I had no idea who Trump was going to nominate, who was on the short list, but when I heard this, I was like, yep. You know, my prediction was it's going to be somebody that's like out there. And this person, if she is indeed one of the nominees, if not the nominee, sounds like she's out there. But nothing surprises me with that bunch anymore, realistically.
No. And Amy Comey Barrett's sort of been on the radar. She was given an appellate court seat in this administration. She was a law professor before that, so she's been like in the ether, I guess is a way to put that. I mean, and it's also like of a piece, like she's part of like a kind of a let's say an unconventional Catholic sect. You know, you have Bill Barr too, who is a member of Opus Dei. So it's not just like these people are religious, they are the uncomfortable, you know, I think for the
weird handshake squad,
who are like form the spectrum of like somewhat spiritual to, you know, agnostic, atheistic, you know, those of us who don't make religion a key part of our identity, like even these people are kind of off-putting too. And the whole thing where he, because I honestly don't think Donald Trump thinks about what he says before he says it. But you know, he's like saying, it's like, "Oh, it was shift making it up," instead of, you know, this being the final message to the public from Ruth Bader Ginsburg as sort of translated from her granddaughter.
You got to get a political shot in there, or it's not worth saying. That's pretty much how he operates.
It's so tactless. I mean, this whole thing has been so tactless. Yeah. Like Mitch McConnell released a statement, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg wasn't even cold yet, and he's issuing statements that are, you know, "Well, we're gonna definitely fill that seat," you know.
The best thing has been the flashback to 4 years ago when Obama was in the same situation, and they threw so many wrenches into that it didn't happen. That was over a period of, I believe, 9 months. This is 40 days, give or take. It might even be less now. Last I heard it was 40 days, but they are shameless. I mean, any, regardless of your politics, when you see somebody do a turn like that, and of course they've got everything on tape now, so you can go back and say, well, actually this, you know, the Ted Cruz, and like you said, McConnell, all of them doing this turn saying, oh no, there's no way Obama should appoint someone so close to the election. And this is like literally minutes away from the election. Oh no, we're, you know, next, we'll have it teed up by next week.
I mean, there's so many levels to this, and one of them is that, yeah, there is tape. We've seen the tapes, and Lindsey Graham literally said,
"Here's another one."
Save this tape for when this happens in 4 years, and it's like, dude, of course we're going to save the tape, but it's as you said, it's so shameless.
Oh,
there's no, you know, they know they can get away with it, and the question though is like, is this going to be like, they're going to win the battle and lose the war? That they're going to cram through this nomination, but ultimately at the end of the day, is Joe Biden, if he should win in November, going to be pressured from the progressive side to increase the size of the court as a response to this? Because it's been,
and that's a possibility, right? That they just sort of expand the goalposts.
There's no set, you know, there's no set constitutional number of Supreme Court justices, unlike Canada, which takes representation into account for our Supreme Court.
Yeah,
regional representation, I should say.
Was it Mulroney that expanded the Senate to get something passed? Like, there, you know, this isn't without precedent. These things happen, right?
And it's not without precedent in the United States either. There's, you know, the number of justices has winged and weighed over, you know, the 200 some odd years. But the point has been made. This isn't completely crazy town. This isn't about partisanship. But when the Supreme Court was created, there were nine regional appellate courts. Now there are 13. Would it not make sense to increase the number of Supreme Court justices to 13 to keep that sort of reflection in terms of because, of course, you know, when you're appointed to the Supreme Court, you come up through that system of the appellate court system, the district court judge system, and then you make it to the Supreme Court. Mm. So it's something to keep an eye on, and it's definitely something that I think that McConnell's okay, I think, losing the Senate as long as he can get this done. But I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think we have any idea what kind of long-term harm it's going to cause, like both the Senate and the Supreme Court, in terms of how they fit politically in the system. It's kind of really short-sighted in that respect.
Interesting times for sure. And rest in peace, Star BG. Holy cow. But and speaking of unprecedented, well, I guess it's not without precedent because we've already had one pandemic election in Canada provincially, and that may be what has inspired the BC election, or there's probably several things that have inspired it. One might be trying to get it in before we're in the second wave, which looks like it's happening. But I was surprised at this, because when we were doing the review of what we're going to talk about this week, and it was like, boom, all of a sudden, there's an election in BC on Saturday, October 24th, which is also trending. For years, there have been people advocating for weekend elections with no pandemic on, obviously, because more people can vote, and that is what's going to happen. It looks like there's going to be an unprecedented amount of mail-in ballots. Curb says there's going to be many, many ways to vote, and they have telephone voting for people with accessibility issues currently. It sounds like that's going to be expanded as well to people that can't vote. So it sounds like even though the pandemic is on, they are extending every possibility to people, and that they should be able to cast a ballot in a month's time. But yeah, that was like snap election time. Whoa. So surprising.
Yeah, it was surprising, although maybe not that surprising. I think when we talked about the results of the New Brunswick election, how minority premier, minority government goes into election with incredible approval ratings, you know, you can sort of justify it's like, here's my chance kind of thing. And I have found it interesting. I think, and maybe it's because it's BC, so maybe there's more of an independent media in British Columbia, that Horgan has been getting hammered for this. People have really been taking him to town for his opportunism, and you know, just the shamelessness of this and the justifications too, because he was coming out saying that the fact that Andrew Weaver, who was the Green Party leader and one of the MLAs from the Green Party in the BC legislature, he had resigned and stepped down. Horgan came out and said, okay, well, now the CASA, I can't remember the acronym.
Confidence and Supply?
Thank you. The Confidence and Supply Agreement, that was now null and void, and they had to have an election. Even though, weirdly enough, they passed unanimously just a couple of months ago a $6 billion COVID relief package.
Ooh.
Unanimously. Liberals, Greens, and NDP.
It's not as if they weren't working together. So I think I've used the word opportunism about 8 times already, but yeah, there's a bit of that going on. I wanted to mention, because initially we were going to talk about the Green Party leadership race, and I don't know if you heard of any of this, Adam, but I watched it play out in real time. There's a battle on the fringe that involves the BC election, but also one of the leadership candidates, Miriam Haddad, for the Green Party of Canada, had endorsed something called the BC Eco-Socialists instead of the Greens at the provincial level, and this presumably is what led to her being kicked out of the race for the federal leadership, you know, 4 days before the Greens are going to go to the polls to decide who the next leader is that will replace Elizabeth May. This all blew up, but then within 24 hours, it would seem she's back in the race. But I thought it was like, wow, that was so, it happened politically fast. Like, it was, and most of us, like, okay, I'm out of the race. Now I'm back in the race. And she's not the first person that was kicked out of and put back into that race. So I thought it was weird that there was a BC angle to it. But one of the leader, I guess, the interim leader, whatever, the leader of the BC Eco-Socialists had to step down over it after campaigning for approximately about 3 hours. So there was some serious excitement right out of the gate there, because generally these kinds of elections aren't that exciting. But I was like, wow, just to watch all of that play out in real time was pretty wild. So I don't know if it's going to get any more wild than that. But
There's also the matter of Anita McPhee, who is an Indigenous woman who was trying to run in the riding of Stikine. And she's in a thing, and there could be legal action because of this, that they had Nathan Cullen, who is a well-known former MP for the NDP from BC. Wow, that was a lot of acronyms.
Yeah, he's running? I haven't heard that.
That he was being parachuted into this riding.
As they do, yeah.
She's making the point that this kind of overrides the party's own nomination system. So this seems to be going around, this who's endorsing who and who's being parachuted where and
who's in charge here. Yeah. Because they all claim not to do it.
It's not pretty all around.
No, they'll say, oh, it's up to the riding association, but then they'll say, well, we didn't have any time. But when you think about it, it was the NDP that called the election. So that is actually a little bit surprising that they would do that. But there were the issues, obviously COVID being top of mind, and the focus so far has been what I would say is the usual, where the NDP are wanting to spend more on what's going on, in particular hospitals and schools, and they're saying, well, the Liberals wrecked everything, and the Liberals are concentrating, at least from what I saw today, on the fact that the hotels have been acting as hostels during this time, as it has actually Canada-wide, I believe, for people, you know, homeless people and whatnot. And they're trying to play the law and order card with this, saying our neighborhoods are a disaster. Sort of echoes of what's going on in Guelph, with hotels being converted into places for the homeless. Actually, that isn't going on yet, but it is a similar story in that the government had initiated this, and so they are able to play the law and order card, although we're only about 48 hours into this. And of course, in mentioning the Greens, they're still trying to find some traction and move beyond three candidates. It was three. And there was the business with Andrew Weaver. That's right. So a fresh new leader, Sonia Firstnow, who said that the fact that this election was called is, quote, irresponsible and unnecessary. And it does sound like, and from what you were saying too, that there are a lot of people in BC that feel that way. So,
yeah, it's a pretty big amount. I mean, having said that, the approval rating for the NDP, or the opinion poll puts them, you know, typically somewhere in the realm of 45 to 50%. So, and, I mean, that is majority government territory when you're talking about those percentages. How it will play out, because I looked up the numbers from the 2017 election, and it was the Liberals had 40.36%, the NDP had 40.28%, and the Liberals finished with 43 seats and the NDP with 41. Mm-hmm. Again, as you said, the Greens had three. The Greens, I mean, again, proportional representation, but 16.84%, they get three. It breaks your heart.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is kind of this dynamism in what's going on with the electorate, in that everybody agrees that this is a very unnecessary election, but at the same time, it seems like Horgan is good to get that majority, and it seems like maybe another situation where the gambit will pay off. I'm not sure.
Well, Horgan is popular personally too, if I understand it right, pushing 70%. So that all helps. And it's not as if they don't look, they just don't look at these numbers. Those are all very, very important. So I guess they're hoping, how do they describe it again? To create certainty and stability. So I can see playing that card, because they've only, you know, I haven't been in very long or too long. So, or no, the election was supposed to be next year. Is that right? Have I got that right?
Yeah, October 21.
Yeah, so bumping it up a year, whatever, right? Like, it's, but I guess if they want to do a solid, depending on how much longer the pandemic rolls on, it looks like it's going to be with us for a while, then maybe it wasn't such a bad move. We won't, you know, obviously won't know if it's a bad move until election day and they get the majority they want. But it's interesting, well, it's they're echoing New Brunswick, which is, you know, a conservative province. So it's like the same, the process is the same, but the parties couldn't be more different, right?
But it's still deeply cynical.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a given.
Politically speaking.
Yeah.
And the fact that every member of both the NDP and the Green caucuses signed the CASA.
Yeah.
It's just like, to put it on the one guy, to put it on the Green on the wall, it's his fault he left. We can't work together anymore. It just rings so hollow, and it's not what you expect from the NDP. It is not the loftyism and the idealism that the NDP usually espouses. And I mean, we don't know how all this is going to play out, but I can't imagine that's going to feel good in the end for a lot of people who are been part of the NDP in BC. I mean, and they could also make a cynical calculation that, you know what, we're the only, I think they're the only NDP government in Canada right now. So,
yes, I said that with such certainty. Eh? Yes, maybe.
I mean, so maybe you just got to play the feds.
If the feds are going to prop up the Liberals in Ottawa, you could argue that they do have a bit of a say there. But that, of course, remains to be seen. And just to go back to that for a second, Adam, post-throne speech, do you know when the vote is for the confidence vote for the throne speech? Any idea of the day?
I don't know the day. I just know that it's next week.
It's next week. Okay. So, yeah, it was within a week. I had some bad intel that said it was going to be the same day, and I'm like, there's no way. So, obviously not. They you should know these things by now. After all these years at the mic, I should know these things by now. But I thought I would ask as sort of a last-minute play thing. But we will be back next week with, once again, Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. Thursdays from 5 to 6, and these days we are being repeated on Friday mornings from 7 to 8. So we are your new drive time show. Let's hope so. Adam, if people want to get in touch with you and learn about what you do, how can they do that?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to GuelphPolitico.ca.
And I am Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and here, as I said, most Thursdays at CFRU 93.3 FM. Thank you once again for joining us, and please tune in next week. You can find us everywhere. You get the internet or waves through the air. So take care, folks, and we'll talk to you next week. We'll be right back.